Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. As you know, on this podcast, we do like to compare and discuss the macro and asset allocation views of the UBS Chief Investment Office, as well as those of our third-party asset manager partners. Joining us for the conversation today, glad to welcome back to my right, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with UBS CIO, Jason Dreho. We're excited to welcome to our UBS podcast studio her first appearance with us, Paula Campbell-Roberts of KKR. Paula serves as Chief Investment Strategist for Wealth at the firm. So with that, Paula, Jason, it's great to have you both joining us here in 1285. Thank you for dropping by and for spending some time today with our listeners and our clients.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Paula, for the first time.
Hopefully not the last.
Definitely not, no.
So there's a lot we want to cover over the next 20, 30 minutes, ranging from monetary policy to geopolitics, no shortage of topics. Though to begin, perhaps, Paula, it would be helpful to hear your reflections. The first half of 2024 has played out relative to your expectations back in January, and now as we're heading into the second half, any expectations, thoughts on what the few months ahead might have in store for investors?
Thanks for the question, Daniel. I'd say certainly we started the year out of consensus thinking that growth would be strong. And I think we've been proven right, and growth has surprised even stronger to the upside. So if you just go by the numbers, 1.3% first quarter GDP, I think second quarter is tracking at 2.5% to 3.5%. So certainly no view on having a hard landing this year. In fact, we'd probably be in the camp of no landing at all with a 2.5% full year growth expectation.
That's your forecast is 2.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think similar to Paula, like, you know, growth has come off from a very elevated level in the second half of last year. So that probably wasn't sustainable. So if I were to think about what is our house view right now, it is, we're in a soft landing and we continue to sort of be in a soft landing, but growth, inflation and rates from their current levels, likely to kind of trend lower as the year goes on, but still to kind of a comfortable level, which ultimately I think for the financial markets is a pretty benign macro environment. Maybe not Goldilocks, but certainly an environment where we think kind of risk assets could do well, which says nothing about the whole AI narrative. We'll probably get into that, but like it's another sort of almost more micro idiosyncratic factor that's kind of supportive, we think, for the market. So I think relatively constructive.
What's so interesting about that, I agree with you, but while we're seeing, you know, strength in, let's say, public equity markets and performance, we're also seeing inflows and strong performance in gold, which I think is just an interesting market dynamic where there's clearly growth and that's good for risk assets, but there's clearly also a lot of uncertainty and volatility.
So how do you, I mean, it's an interesting point because if you look at over the past 5 years, maybe 10 years, the relationship between gold and, say, like real interest rates has mm-hmm. been pretty tightly correlated, meaning as real interest rates go higher, price of gold goes lower because your opportunity cost of holding gold that's not giving you any yield is going
that's
up.
That's right.
That relationship for the past year or so has kind of broken down in a way that if it held, gold should not be at 2,300, 2,400. It should be at like 1,700.
Right.
So what do you attribute that? Like, is it risk off? Is it safe haven? Is it inflation concerns, geopolitical, something other? Like
some combination of those last four factors. I'd say it's part of the fear factor, right? There's clearly, you know, upside in productivity growth and some of the supply side shocks that we've seen from immigration, for example, and the market is buying that. But at the same time, we still have all of the concerns around geopolitics and some of these inflationary forces that are not quite well understood. And so I think, you know, as opposed to finding diversification and hedging in sort of your bonds, you're finding it a little bit in gold. So I think you're sort of playing two sides of the market.
It is like because it's, you know, gold. It's not something we generally recommend as a part of a strategic asset allocation because historically it's been equity volatility, roughly, and bond-like returns, which is, you know, the bad quadrant to be in.
Sure.
But at the same time, when I kind of see what's going on, I do wonder, is the market sort of signaling something where, like, we ultimately believe that inflation will stay elevated, you know, despite what market pricing might indicate? Is that kind of, you know, as a kind of hedge for the next 5 years, decade, is it how much of a geopolitical hedge, risk-off hedge, or even like there is data that shows like central banks are buying, you know, more gold to diversification,
well,
which means it's just almost a bit of a supply and demand story. It's like demand curve shifting out, supply is somewhat fixed, all sequel prices have to go higher.
I'd be in your camp. It's not a recommendation that we make. Clearly, we focus on private markets. It's more just what I'm seeing as a reflection of sentiment in the market, and the fact that there's a desire to hedge out. There's a lot of uncertainty. We clearly would suggest to answer that uncertainty in a different way, but just acknowledging that that's where investors are. And to your point, it's not just individual investors. It's also sovereign wealth funds and institutions as well that are feeling this level of fear or uncertainty in the market.
So you're optimistic on growth. Like 2.5% is a little bit above consensus, but like it's a good number by any kind of way you think about it. What about inflation, though? Do you believe inflation is going to come down? How much? And then, by extension, what does it mean for the Fed if growth is not slowing much, inflation is or not coming down? Does the Fed cut at all?
I believe the Fed is in no rush to cut rates at all. I was actually just at a lunch at the Economic Club of New York talking with John Williams, and he affirmed that point of view, which in our house view is that the Fed doesn't cut until next year, and next year it does so 4 times. And if you think about it, you and I have talked about this before, there are these structural forces or tectonic shifts that are upholding inflation. And so we're definitely in the higher inflation bias, higher rates camp for longer. And so just quickly, they range from the energy transition, which is on net inflationary, the sort of global security concerns that are driving nearshoring and the like, even demographics where you've kind of, you've benefited from immigration, but still there in parts of the labor market, you're still going to experience shortages. So that wage inflation is going to continue to drive inflation higher. And then finally, even AI, which you would think of as the release valve for these higher levels of inflation in the short term, just given the demands on water, on energy, and even on labor, that too is inflationary in the short term. So for all of those reasons, we don't see inflation coming down to 2%, certainly not this year and not next year. And what I was surprised to hear at the luncheon just now is even John Williams, New York Fed chair, said that he wouldn't expect inflation to come down to 2% until 2026, I think he said.
Which I think is, if you look at the Fed's economic projections, even by the end of 25, it's still above target. So it would basically be 26. Williams, I wouldn't say he's an overly dovish person, but he's been got some notoriety late last year when the Fed started to kind of pivot a little bit more to being a dovish perspective, talking about the idea of preemptive cuts. Mm-hmm. And I think if you looked at sort of various rules of the Fed, like a Taylor rule, like what the Fed could be doing, I think he's kind of like as an academic kind of adheres to some of those thinkings. At least that's my perception, that he would be one of the people sort of making the case that, yes, inflation's high, but we should probably be like it's above target, but it's trending lower. Policy is restrictive, and therefore it should go lower. So he said they're in no rush, which I think they're clearly gotten the sheet. Just everyone says the same thing.
Yes.
Like we're patient and policy's in a good place. But did he give any of the kind of insights like, in the speech of like how he thinks about policy, what they might be doing, which could then, if you try to connect the dots, would imply like, well, then what he really believes is by September we should be able to cut. So we're not in a rush, but like that could also mean, in 3 months we might be there.
It's a great question. He tried very hard to avoid answering the question on timing. But what's clear is he doesn't necessarily believe that there are structural forces that have changed this regime into something different, right? And I'm a part of the economic advisory panel, as you know. And so he doesn't believe we're going to get down to 2% anytime soon, but does believe that there are signs that we will get there without any new understanding of underlying forces driving inflation. So it's two sides of the coin a little bit, because, we had a debate around R star. He doesn't necessarily think R star is very much higher productivity.
He doesn't think there's a short term and long term R star, or like in a way that would be, because some of your colleagues have sort of taught kind of floated that day. He is like, I think in the main model that you go into Bloomberg and look at the R star.
Yeah.
He's one of the three authors.
He is.
So he might be biased towards believing that's the right framework.
Yeah.
But he could also kind of allow himself some wiggle room. He's like, well, maybe short term, that could be a little bit different. Did he give an indication?
That's probably fair. I don't know that he would call it that R star is different in the short term versus longer term, but he definitely has affirmed that in the short term, inflation will be higher and it will take, rates need to be higher given that level of inflation. But to tie that necessarily to the model, I don't know that he's done
there.
That.
Yeah. Because
right.
if he, like I'm not trying to speak for John Williams, but
yes.
Suppose you believe that R star hasn't changed and therefore the neutral Fed funds rate is like 2.5, 2.75. Policy is quite restrictive versus the people who would say the short term it's maybe 4, 4.5, in which case policy is not restrictive. So if he really believes that, he should then believe that policy is quite restrictive.
Which is what he believes.
And so therefore inflation might be high, but it's got a problem. in that sense, probably got to come down relatively quickly. At least that's, he can say one thing, but like, you know, if he really believes the model, then he's probably has to believe that's true as well.
And that's right. Those are the set of facts that need to be true, given what he said. And so what he's probably more in the camp of delayed, you know, delayed, long and delayed lags, mm-hmm. right? That we are getting to the monetary policy is restrictive. We're seeing weakness in the economy. It's going to work its way through the economy, not in 3 months, but maybe over 6 to 12 months. That's more his case. Cut.
If we think beyond the next 6 months, like the rest of this year, 12 months, three cuts or four cuts you're forecasting next year. Mm-hmm. But thinking longer term, like next 2, 3, 5 years, I know KKR has kind of written about kind of a regime. How do you think about kind of the growth and inflation kind of regime over that time period? And what does it mean ultimately? Is the Fed cut four times next year and it's done? Or is it like, you know, like the extent that you're kind of thinking longer term, like where does the Fed settle?
Given I think that we've penciled in additional cuts in 2026. We think, you know, long-term growth is, you know, trends back towards 2% is what our house view is. And inflation then settles around 2.5%. So still elevated versus history, but not, you know, at 7% or 9% versus, you know, in what we saw a couple of years ago.
So do you, I think I saw your colleague Henry McVey on CNBC a couple of weeks ago. And I saw it like a clip of it where he was talking about kind of productivity growth, which is something that like I've been thinking like I would err on the side of the risk is like growth, not the risk, but like growth could be more like 2.5% going forward, in part because for the rest of this decade, we could get elevated, you know, productivity, which then I agree on the inflation side, it's kind of biased to the upside. So you add it together. You know, I've kind of described the economy as a 6% economy, mm-hmm. meaning 6% nominal GDP.
Right.
Now, I don't think we'll stay there, but like titling it the 5.35 economy is not as exciting as a blog title.
Yes.
But in that range of 5 to 6%, has the house view given sort of like all this data we're seeing, like investments high, AI development seem to be accelerating. Has that changed in the past 6 months or year, kind of your thinking of like how this would play out in one way or another?
I think we're still in the same camp that we were. So our upside cases, I think you wrote a great paper on this, by the way.
Thank you.
sort of the upside case of the AI investment that we've seen really translates in a diffuse way into productivity gains that is north of the average productivity of 1.5%, which is what we've experienced over the past 100 years, right? Mm-hmm. That's our bull case. From what we've seen in our portfolio companies, when we're talking to corporates, we're talking to CEOs, we're not quite there yet in the base case term that we're going to see this whole AI transformation of the way we do work that's going to drive us to, let's say, your 6% nominal GDP growth. We think that AI is going to be meaningful and certainly improve earnings, but that's going to be the new technology that allows us to meet our 1.5% productivity growth that we've averaged over the past 100 years. So in the same way that maybe whatever, the first transformation was education, moving from an agrarian society and people went to school and went to colleges, and that had an impact on productivity. And that's how we got to 1.5% in that regime. The next regime was, you know, maybe not the internet.
But, there's some stuff in between.
There's some stuff in between. But you can imagine that there's always something. There's always something new that allows us to achieve this remarkable level of productivity growth for 100 years. And so the question is whether this is just the next thing or, in our bull case, your base case, whether this is something much greater and transformative where you get to a 6% nominal GDP.
I mean, like that's definitely on the optimistic end. But like even going from 1.5% productivity growth, say, to 2%, mm-hmm. you factor in labor force growth, like it takes growth from 2% to 2.5%. And that's kind of an inflation from 2% as it was last decade to, say, 2.5%. That difference between 4 to 5%, in some way not huge, but it's also like not kind of trivial in terms of like more like interest rates. Again, that's like these are kind of small differences, but I think the market is still or had been, people had been sort of anchored on, you know, we're going to go back to 2% inflation and go back to 2% growth. And
right.
I think on both fronts, people are like open-minded more today than even 6 months ago, a year ago to, you know, actually we might be on the high side kind of persistently. I want to just come back to a comment you made about, you know, you're talking to, you know, your portfolio companies. When you kind of present this economic thesis, which like from a growth perspective is, again, you know, pretty constructive, mm-hmm. And also kind of the inflation story, is it kind of, do you get like kind of nods like, you know, that makes sense to us, you know, from like business leaders? It's more like, we don't see that from our business. And in part because like some of the economic data recently in the U.S., you know, from the April, early May timeframe was surprising to the downside.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that was more on the sentiment side.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd wonder is if, are you hearing things from your companies that are consistent with your view, or is there a disconnect that you almost have to convince them, no, like things aren't quite as bad as you think, or not?
It's a very interesting question. I'd say I take it from a couple of different standpoints. One, the market, and in general, I'd say CEOs want to will the market back to a lower interest rate, right? Whether or not the data is showing that or not, the market wants to believe that we're headed back to some mean reversion of rates being much lower, and then all the capital on the sidelines would lean in. I'd say once we talk about the tectonic shifts and we talk about what's fundamentally going on in the economy, everyone's on board, because there's no questioning, even if, you know, in our view, it's not that we go wholesale from fossil fuels to renewables, but even the trends that we are noticing continuing in at this pace, and then security, demographics. When you talk about that, I think everyone appreciates that it makes sense that inflation and rates are going to be higher. In fact, you know, Henry McVeigh runs a team called, you know, Global Balance Sheet Risk and Macro, and there are 40 professionals from around the world, and we did a poll recently on whether our call on higher for longer, if whether or not you agree with it. There's never been a survey question where we've had this response, but 100% of the team said, yes, that's the right call. So I think that reflects, you know, once you look at the data, once you think about all of the trends, it just makes a lot of sense that it would trend higher. And again, we're not talking about massively higher. 2.5% inflation is not crazy.
No, and it's you know, it's actually below where we are now, so it's
right,
not
exactly
all crazy. It is interesting that the 100% agreed with the view. That is more of a, I guess, medium longer term view, like what you're describing, kind of higher for longer. If that's like, it's not a 6 month view. This is like a 2 to 3 year view, would you say?
Right. I would say, I wouldn't say longer. I would say short to medium term view. So next 5 years.
Oh, well, so that, I would classify that anything beyond like a year feels like it's medium term, and like, you know.
Okay. These
are all semantics. But it's interesting that there's sort of that kind of consensus, because I've noticed recently, more on the tactical side, the next 6 months or so, there seems to be a pretty strong consensus view, like recession risk is low. I think, yes, like 10-15% of investors would say a recession starts the next year. 40% might be soft landing. 40% are probably in this no landing camp. Beyond, but it's, again, this is a 6 to 12 month view. I think beyond that, I'm not sure. I'm surprised to hear there's so much consensus that people would believe we are in a structurally higher regime. If it was 80-20, but the only reason I kind of pointed out is when I think about like the markets are doing well this year, I kind of feel comfortable with the macro, like we share the macro environment. Where could we be wrong? But also, like, if there's a lot of consensus, is that going to pose risks from the market's perspective? And it both short term, it feels like there's a strong consensus, but what you're describing is like maybe there's a pretty strong consensus there. Where does that make the markets kind of, you know, vulnerable? I don't have a great answer. Maybe, you know, curious how you would think about that.
What I would offer is I actually wouldn't say that higher for longer is necessarily a rosy outlook on the economy. I'd say, you know, it's a new regime where, you know, and we've seen in prior regimes, asset classes reset to these new level of rates. But that doesn't, we're still talking about 2% trend GDP growth. So we're not saying anything, you know, extreme on that front. I just think that this cycle is very different from prior cycles, where historically you would expect, you know, a diffuse slowdown in the economy where all sectors, consumer, corporate, et cetera, would all slow down at the same time. There would be synchronicity to that, and you would have recession. I think what we're experiencing now, even in this higher for longer regime, is more of a rolling recession where you're going to have weakness in the economy. And we do expect another shoe to drop, but just not wholesale all sectors of the economy to contract at the same time. So we would argue that last year you saw housing, that shoe drop, you saw inventory, you had an inventory cycle. And then it's really just this quarter where, you know, the upside surprise in GDP, a lot of that is driven by inventory. But then there's probably going to be another shoe that drops that we would argue would be the consumer, maybe already seeing it in lower income consumers. But I think that's just the type of cycle we're in. So it's not, I think I would caution the market to think it's, you know, all clear. It's really watch out for where you're going to have weakness in the economy, and therefore think about diversification, think about mitigating risk, and hence why many are leaning into gold.
Oh, yeah. I like the way you brought that back.
You know, a little clever there.
I was having a conversation with a client, you know, just earlier today, where we kind of came to sort of a bit of a punchline at the end. Like, this is a highly unusual cycle. Mm-hmm. So one, you're dealing with still with after effects of the pandemic that's kind of distorted relationships, so which may never go back to what they were, both economically, how we live our lives, like just work from home or not. Some other relationships in terms of, you mentioned, like rolling recession, like it's been different parts of the economy have been disrupted at different points in time. This is also coming after a period of time where I kind of look at the last 50 years and like the U.S. economy has evolved, that it's very different today than, say, the 1970s. So some of the comparisons when we talked about stagflation, like it's like this is not a 1970s economy. All of which is more, to, I think, leads to for a little bit for investors is that we are flying a little bit blind in terms of, like, what is this regime? I think we kind of agree that there's a different regime, and this is not like last decade. Right. But what is that regime? Like, how much higher will growth be? Will inflation be? Productivity? All these kind of things. And a little bit of, I kind of go back to last fall, especially like in September, October, then like November, December, where just look at the 10-year went from 3.8% to 5% in about 8 weeks.
That's right.
And then in less than 8 weeks, it went back down to like, you know, under 4%. And it went from Goldilocks to like, uh-oh, we're going to be really high for longer. Then all of a sudden, no, actually things are going to be okay. So there's a little bit of like when the markets move that quickly, it feels like there's people are not fully anchored on what the view is. And they kind of, they're still kind of moving around and sort of coalescing, like what's the right model and template and framework to think about. It sounds like, you know, if I go back to the kind of consensus view among the team, it's like more and more people accepting like this is the regime that we're in. And it's instead of like a whole range of views, it's getting at least truncating some of the possible distributions. What it means for the markets and maybe the less, little less volatility, like big kind of swings that we saw. But I could see things also kind of, you know, being still disrupted in some ways that like maybe more and more people think we are going to grow at 5%+ or so we'll get some sort of productivity that, like, people start to kind of think that this is something, you know, different. It's more of a context of trying to make sense of all that's kind of going
sure.
on, you know, and kind of wrestling through it. And then ultimately, as you say, kind of the investment decisions. I think the key point of diversification.
That's right.
It's when you don't really have a great sense of, or your confidence in any one scenario is maybe less than it otherwise would be, and the markets can perform differently, then the best thing to do, since you can't time it and markets move quickly, is to ultimately kind of have that diversified portfolio.
I completely agree. And I would argue just on one point that you made on volatility, I'd actually expect to see more volatility going forward in light of everything we've just described. So higher for longer, higher inflation bias, higher rates, and more volatility because of the geopolitics, interest rate, you know, I'd expect more of that, but that the conclusion is still the same, that diversification needs to become a priority and a focus for all investors. And so if you're in a 60-40 portfolio today where bonds are not performing their shock absorption function, you definitely need to diversify outside of there. And of course, from our point of view, we've gotten a lot of benefit from diversification into private markets, especially in real assets, where you're talking about a higher inflation environment and you can get those collateral-based cash flows. Leaning into places like infrastructure, I think, is a very good bet alongside sort of this new, within this sort of new regime that we're talking about.
So kind of transitioning to kind of investments, you've already kind of alluded to some of this. Like at KKR is a long-term investor. You're not necessarily thinking like, you know, next 6 weeks, you know, a couple of months. So you're not going to be overly tactical, I think, in your views, although you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. But you could still have biases relative to like what is a typical allocation. We like these things more than others, whether it's in within equities, fixed income, real estate. So what are kind of areas that you think are, you know, relatively attractive across different asset classes right now?
And whenever I get this question, I always start with none of these are cookie cutter asset classes or solutions. We really try to think about what you're trying to solve for. And you know, not all investors are the same. And so we have investors who are much more focused on generating income. They want to fund their lifestyle today versus others that are focused on just compounding return and maximizing return. And you and I have talked mm-hmm. about that mm-hmm. before. And depending on, you know, what your priority and objectives are, what I'd recommend or what I like might be a little bit different. So in terms of those who are focused on generating income, certainly private credit continues to be a great asset class to be in, given the risk-free rate and then the premium you can get on top of the spread on top of that. It's still a great place to be in, especially, I think the market doesn't understand this, but they're actually much higher quality companies in the universe today, and you're lending at much lower leverage levels. And even loss ratios, which is, you know, a concern, is that tend to be actually much lower than you find in high yield. So I think private credit is just going to continue to be a more strategic place to play, especially from an income perspective going forward.
So on private credit,
yeah.
The CEO of a well-known bank recently came out and made some comments like about private credit, concerns that there could be issues. Not saying there is, there could be issues. So if someone were to ask you like, you know, how legitimate are those concerns? Are there issues like there is a lot of money in private credits that's come in the asset class? Does it mean lending standards are getting disrupted in some way? Like, how would you address those concerns? Just like, look, there could be problems in any asset class, but X, Y, and Z are reasons why things still look, you know, okay.
What I would say is certainly manager selection is always important, right? You want to avoid a situation where you're going to be subject to adverse selection for a manager who's just trying to do deals. That's where I would say the risk is in the system. But, you know, for those players who've been doing private credit for a long time and have real global books and understand the underlying companies, especially if you think about a private equity company who's both, you know, used to owning companies outright as well as lending to them, you get good sides, you know, good views on the ledger, the income statement and balance sheet of different companies. I'd say there's probably less risk for those, you know, higher quality private lenders than most people would imagine. I understand the scrutiny because it's just an asset class that people hadn't focused on before, and it's received a lot of attention in the past few years. But we've been doing it, for example, for a very long time. And so when we look at our book, and if you think of any manager who has, you know, pretty stringent risk standards and the like, and is really looking for higher quality companies, I actually think you can fare very well in private credit.
And going to some of the other, not asset classes, but like the way you're thinking of like capital appreciation or other
yes.
things, like what are some of the other things that in particular you think are interesting opportunities right now?
So I mentioned infrastructure, which, you know, you mentioned Goldilocks before, I think mm-hmm. has emerged as a bit of a Goldilocks asset class in, you know, 2022, when most of your traditional asset classes underperformed, so both stocks and bonds, fixed income, et cetera, you saw global private infrastructure put up 7% returns, right? And so what I like about it, especially if you're thinking about essential assets, so not, you know, bridges and tolls are essential, but that's not what I'm talking about. But think about fiber, right? Fiber is going to do well regardless of whether we're in a recession or not. Leaning into those secular trends where it's not going to go away in a recession, but also you get exposure to these upside alpha, you know, secular trends around digitization, I think it's very compelling. So infrastructure, I would lean into both from an income perspective, as well as from when we talked about compounding returns because of that alpha exposure.
Do you think it leans one way more than the other, or does it just depend on the type of investment or what the fund is sort of set up to do?
It certainly depends on the strategy. I would say it's, you know, depending on the strategy, it could actually deliver close to private equity returns and then income somewhere in the middle of maybe real estate and private credit. So I'd say delivers on both, but it's going to be highly dependent on the manager's strategy. That's the thing. I think infrastructure from manager to manager could look very different. So you'd really have to look under the hood and say, what is your strategy and what expectations do you have from a return and yield perspective?
When you talk to different types of clients who are about this asset class, do you find, like, is there like some want it for more of the income, some want it for the capital depreciation? Like, is there a whole range of how they use it? Because you say like it's what the manager is to do, but there also has to be kind of a buyer of the opportunity.
I find that most people initially want it for the downside protection and the income, and then they are pleasantly surprised about the upside.
Oh, I did not expect to get 10% returns.
Yeah, exactly. I'll take that.
Okay. So private credit, infrastructure.
And then I would say private equity, there we've gotten lots of questions of in this, you know, higher for longer regime, how does private equity deliver? And I actually think this is exactly the time when you want to lean into private equity. Historically, when you've had dislocation, when you've had uncertainty, that's when private equity really delivers that excess return. And there are also many historical periods where you've had high rates and private equity has still delivered. So it's proven itself in these types of environments. So at this entry point where you can get, you know, asset class, especially in the mid-cap space where you've seen some repricing, where you could enter at a good basis and then deliver that return with the excess return on top of it, I think it could be pretty compelling. So I'd say private equity as well.
On that point about like entry points, not all, but some equities obviously are public in the public markets. Not cheap.
Yeah.
So how would you, but there's also like we think of like small cap stocks as the Russell 2000 index is traded at a discount to like PE to the S&P. Historically, it's traded at a premium. So there's clearly some value there. But on a historical basis, would you say this is a cheap environment, like a relatively cheap or like, you know, is it more like you, it's asset by asset or company by company, there's opportunity?
That's what I would say. I don't think it's a broad brush. Certainly, you know, as we've talked about, large cap valuations are certainly trending higher, but I think there are opportunities and value in the mid cap space. I think clearly, as from a public perspective, I'd be very careful about investing in especially small caps today, right? Because all of the headwinds we're talking about are going to be much more difficult for a smaller firm. But from a private equity perspective, a mid-cap firm that has, you know, good bones and where you can add your value creation toolkit, so employee ownership, you know, make sure you're aligned on the right geography, the right products, et cetera, and really deliver on that illiquidity premium, I think that's where the opportunity is. That the fact that you have, you know, more decent valuations in that mid-cap space and the opportunity to apply the private equity playbook, I think that's a great place, especially this year where you're starting to see M&A activity pick up.
Does it make a difference if the company's already exist, like a mid-cap company that's already public, or something that like is owned that's private? Is there like a valuation discount even more so for those companies that are private as opportunities for fund managers?
I think it would be case by case. I wouldn't paint any of these with a broad brush. Certainly, we've seen a lot of opportunity in what we call corporate carve-outs. So you have a large conglomerate with lots of different subsidiaries, and there's one asset or company subsidiary that's unloved or doesn't receive as much attention, but turns out to be a very valuable asset. That's a play that we've applied, you know, all over the world.
On the small caps, I should disclose that we have a most preferred on small caps, which, like, there's, you know, there's valid reasons to be concerned. Like what you've, yes. You know, right now, it's like this year, it's probably traded almost as a proxy for rates. When rates are rising, it's more of a concern. Like, you could pose financial stress on these companies. Mm-hmm. When rates are declining, like today, like a small decline in rates, and you see some of small caps kind of, you know, rally. Ultimately, in an environment where we think kind of goes to our macro view, like growth, inflation, and then also ultimately rates moderating this year, like we're calling for 2 rate cuts. That should be a tailwind. If you don't think there's rate cuts, then you could see, you know, you'd probably take a different view. But I'd also acknowledge all the structural challenges. I think we're thinking it more like as a cyclical or tactical kind of, you know, outperformance potential for small versus large. But it is predicated on the thesis working, because I think there are the structural reasons that perhaps work against it. So I think we could both be right, but different horizons and different reasons.
I agree with that.
So I think that's a...
30 minutes goes quick, means we'll have to do a part two at some point.
Yeah. I would love to. Thank you, Jason.
No, absolutely. We'd like to have you back sometime soon.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
Investing in an alternative investment fund is speculative and involves significant risks. For a discussion on these risks, please visit ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer-NTA.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.